If you enjoy podcasts like this, you should check out our other shows on Health Podcast Network. For example, Better with Dr. Erica, hosted by Dr. Erica, provides support and guidance in navigating stress-related challenges to transform your relationship to self-care. Each episode arms you with the tools needed to be better, do better, and live better. There was an incredible episode that you should check out called Touch and Connections as Tools for Healing and Better Mental Health. In this episode, her guest breaks down ways to use physical touch as a form of healing for trauma and grief. Check out Better with Dr. Erica on your favorite podcast platform or visit healthpodcastnetwork.com.
Welcome to Highway to Health. I'm Jeremy Quinby. This is episode 92 of the podcast. If you're a new listener, I want to welcome you. Highway to Health is your place for trusted health guidance and support. Whether you're looking to improve your health or just seeking ways to stay well, we're here for you. This growing community is on a mission to improve your state of well-being and our experience together. And if you love the thoughtful content that you get here, consider becoming a health amplifier today and join this community over at patreon.com/highwaytohealth. And for the price of a cup of coffee once a month, you can help us provide free resource to anyone looking to improve their health and quality of life and the quality of this programming. I'm so excited to share this conversation with you today with Tad Wanvier, one of my teachers from the Upledger Institute in Palm Beach Gardens, Florida, where I've been studying this method of osteopathic treatment since the late 90s. Since he's the first person from this amazing place, I'd like to take a moment to acknowledge both the work of Dr. John Upledger and all the teachers and staff there who go to great lengths to ensure that this method is taught right. And, you know, for the time and effort that they put into the study materials and for their presence and their patience and care and everything that I've experienced working with them, and that includes the TAs and organizers and my fellow students and colleagues. This work and field of study for me has become more than just coursework. It's about continuing to hone my skills as a constructive thinker, active listener, and most importantly, a compassionate human being. I came across Tad's work when I was prepping for a lecture about 10 years ago. It was the first time that I had seen animated models of the craniosacral system, which for those of you who are new to this term is the dural membrane system, which is the fluid sac that houses the brain and spinal cord, and the cerebrospinal fluid that bathes and nourishes it. The nervous system is what immediately drew me in when I started my career. I was still an active musician at the time, and just as I would explore the roots of musical styles like jazz, blues, classical, and African music as it related to rock or funk, I felt like if I was going to really understand how the body worked, I needed to look to the source, to the root source there, which I started to feel was the central nervous system. And as I learned that there was a saline tide moving within this electrical system that cleans, detoxifies, balances, and energizes all function, my curiosity just took over. So nearly 25 years later, I've gotten more interested in the function at the cellular level, and this is where Tad comes in again. In 2016, I saw he was teaching a course on cellular activity within this craniosacral system in my city, so I immediately signed up. And so for reference, the brain is comprised of two cell types, neurons and glia. Most people have heard of neurons, and that's because they've gotten most of our attention, most of the attention of the neuroscientists, at least for years. But in the past 20 years, it's become clear that glial cells are the major regulators of the nervous system, its development, structure, and function. And as it relates to my field, I needed to understand better this glial matrix that also happens to be attached to the dural membrane system that I'm working with daily. And there's more evidence now, even within the past 5 or 10 years, that improving glial function might be the key to preventing Alzheimer's, ALS, Parkinson's, a number of autoimmune conditions, as well as depression and mood disorders. So this one is full of insight, not only scientifically, but to human consciousness and perhaps beyond. Please enjoy my conversation with Tad Wanvier. So you lived in New York for some period of time as well, right?
A little over 25 years.
Did you grow up there?
No, I grew up in D.C.
Oh, is that right?
So I was in Brooklyn. I was most of the time, well, downtown Brooklyn. So it was in Evans Street, top of Flatbush and Fulton Street.
Oh, yeah.
Where they intersect. So, yeah, so there was a loft building there. Originally, it was called the Corn Exchange Bank, and this great guy, Alatera, bought it, and he turned it into lofts for artists.
Yeah.
And, so I had like a 4,000 square foot loft there.
Unbelievable.
I was paying, at first, I would think it was $320 a month.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it was like 4,000 square feet. I mean, fourth floor. It was a great place. Yeah.
That's
just full of crazy artists.
Yep. Mm-hmm. What time period?
I think I moved there in 75.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So that's when, Soho was still Soho. And,
yep.
And just a bunch of artists. And, the Plant District was the Plant District, and the Shmata District was Shmata. So things have changed a lot.
Yeah. I mean, I got to see just the end of the transition on some level. I think I moved there in 2000, and I worked in Tribeca, one of the first jobs that I had when I was there, and Tribeca was just starting to kind of like, there were still empty buildings everywhere, yeah. but you could still sort of see, and I just tended to treat more, I'm a musician myself, so I tended to treat more creatives, within 4 years maybe. And that's even with 9/11 happening, just the shift that happened there was just so fast.
Yeah true. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it's interesting. I ended up taking one of your first glia classes, and I don't know if you recall this, but I'm sure you've taught a lot of people, but I just looking at the timeline of things, you must have started teaching that class was in like early maybe 2016, and so the book must have just come out at that point, I imagine.
Yeah, I was teaching the class before I published the book.
Oh, did you?
Yeah, I had no intention of even publishing the book, and then I had the first class, and someone in that class said, "Well, you should take a study guide and just create then just take it into a book form instead of expand on the material." And so that's how it started.
Okay. Who was suggesting this to you?
Oh, Sue Cotta?
Yeah.
So I love Sue, and so we've known one another for a long time. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I preparing to talk to you, I kind of poured through the book again for the third time. I have two copies, by the way, because I thought I had lost one in a move, and it turned out it was in my office the whole time. So,
thanks.
So, just going through it all again, I was reminded of something that happened when I was taking your class, because I think we were kind of getting deep into astrocytes and astrogliosis or something. And I just kept asking you questions in the class about some very specific process I wanted to know about. And you sort of, at one point you said, "What are you, man, an engineer?" Yeah. And you kept from that point on, that drew a lot of laughs. So every time I raised my hand, I kept getting called the engineer. But as I was going back through this book again, I was like, "You're calling me an engineer?" Like the detail of and that you go into with this stuff, trying to get your head around the models and the writing that had to go along with it to really describe what was going on. I mean, it's an incredible amount of work. How long did it take you to do this book?
Years, it began with a study guide, and then writing the study guide and doing illustrations for the study guide,
yeah.
And then expanding on that, and of course doing more research all the time,
yeah,
and then more drawings, and then editing.
It's I know,
like in music editing, it's just a beast.
Yeah. And, even for the podcast.
I would think so. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So it took at least after the study guide was completed, when I started the book, probably 2.5 years, I would think.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I mean, that seems short to me, just considering how much information is in there.
Yeah, well, it was a lot of research went in beforehand, and a lot of work had been done before actually getting to work on the book. Yeah,
I just saw something not too long ago about it was a TED talk. Someone was talking about where I'm trying to figure out how I got interested in Glee. I can't. Maybe it was just from seeing some of your work, but they were kind of going back through the timeline of you know where they started understanding more about these cells, and or just about the extracellular matrix in general. And mm-hmm. that we became such a neuron-focused culture, but when they did some sort of study, I think with Einstein's brain, mm-hmm. where they had maybe another, you know, there's like 20 different male brains around the same age, and you know they were in looking at all the you know neurons, everything seemed about the same, but when they looked at the extracellular matrix, they realized there was he was just off the charts. You know, people talk about his brain size as being not very big. But apparently it's that matrix that really, you know, defines our ability to sort of process or our behaviors and all sorts of things. Is that the way you see it?
I thought with Einstein's brain that they found a higher ratio of glial cells to neurons.
Right. And they said
in that particular area.
Yeah. Oh, just a particular area?
Well, they only had that one little area.
Okay.
Yeah. So they didn't have his whole brain, so they couldn't really relate that area to total brain.
Gotcha.
And that's a very new aspect of glial research, I mean, currently, because, you know, any cell will specialize to its environment, to its microenvironment. Mm-hmm. And so now that there's more and more glial information, what are there more specific types of like astrocytes and different types of the brain because they'll specialize for various specific functions.
Yeah.
So with that particular part of astrocyte, Einstein's brain, yeah, they found a much higher ratio of astrocytes to neurons.
What drew you into the glia in the first place?
You know, I was on staff at the Upledger Institute for about 5.5 years. And half of that time I was director of the intensive therapy program and then worked as a clinician in the program as well.
Okay.
And so in that program, in those days, it's different now, but in those days, clients would come really from all over the world, and they usually had rather complex, long-standing issues, except for we had children in the program too. Right. But usually pretty complex issues. And one day I was just looking around the room, and we would always have 5 to 6 clients in the room and many therapists. And it was really a great, wonderful program. And I was looking around the room one day and I was just looking at the improvements in the clients in that program. I was thinking about improvements in clients in previous programs. And I thought, well, this is great, but how in the world is this happening?
Yeah.
I mean, you have your hands on someone for X amount of hours per day. And you see these improvements and these changes, improved health and well-being, mobility, focus, right?
Yeah.
So my training at that time, like most of us in the cranial world, was that basically you enhance a focus to enhance the meningeal system to enhance the structure and function of the central nervous system.
And for anybody listening, just so we kind of can bring, you know, the crowd along a little bit is that, you know, that system we're talking about is the meningeal system, is the dural membrane system and all the, you know, surrounding structure.
Just as an overview, that the brain and the spinal cord tissue and fluids are encased in 3 sacs.
Yeah.
And those 3 sacs are connective tissue, also known as fascia. So there are three, you can think of it as a three-layered bag.
Yeah.
And the innermost bag is called the pia mater membrane, which means tender mother membrane. And the tender mother membrane cradles the brain tissue, brain and spinal cord tissue. So then the thought in the craniosacral therapy through Dr. Upledger and others was that you enhance those bags, those structural bags, to decrease deformation in those bags, which helps to enhance the form of the brain and the spinal cord. And then the thought was, if you help to enhance the form, meaning the structure of cells, that will naturally increase their ability to self-correct and heal. So then the question for me in that moment was that by our hands, if we think of our hands are linked to, let's say, at the head, that are interconnected to connective tissue that's interconnected to bone, and the bone is interconnected to these three sacs. And we get to the pia mater membrane, the tender mother membrane. What happens from there? How does our, how do we influence beyond the pia mater membrane?
So that became your interest, is there's more there that we just didn't know enough about yet.
Well, I certainly didn't, because then I got to that question in myself, and it was ended up with, I don't know.
and what were you able to find at that point? Was there enough research, or did people understand that matrix yet?
Well, you know, I mean, I could have easily gone down the hall and just talked to Dr. Upledger about it, see what his take was, but I just wanted to figure it out myself.
Yeah.
And so I spent months just pouring through anatomy books, and because glial wasn't part of my consciousness at that time, you know, because the focus was all neuropathology, neurons. Looking, and finally I saw this little illustration in an anatomy book that a lot of people have called Netter's Anatomy. And there was this little teeny drawing, and it showed the pia mater membrane, and then it showed the neurons, and then these cells called glial cells that wrapped around the neurons, the axons, which are extensions of the neurons, and then were adhered to the inner surface of the pia mater membrane.
Yeah.
And then they were adhered to one another throughout this little section of the drawing. And I thought, wow, that's fascinating. Well, what are these cells, glial cells? And that's how it all began. And I started to research. But that would have been about 2002.
Okay.
And there wasn't a huge amount of glial research at the time, but I read what I could find, and and then just kept going on from there.
And Upledger's Cell Talk book must have come out sometime close to that, right? That's kind of where he was kind of starting to look at the cellular function and activity as it relates to consciousness. You know, he was really kind of stretching, I think, right? What we really understood about how our you know, cellular memory worked, and just the whole function as it related to the nervous system too.
Yeah, I mean, Cell Talk was the last book that Dr. Upledger wrote.
Yeah, wasn't that early 2000s, if I'm not mistaken, somewhere around there?
It would have been about 2003-ish. I mean, I was at the clinic, working there at the time, and I was fortunate. He asked me to illustrate the book. I could have done 1,000 illustrations for that book, but we really didn't have much time.
Yeah.
So I only did a few. So it was a great experience to be able to read the book, talk to him about it, and about his thoughts about the biology, cellular biology, but then moving beyond that into fields of universal consciousness. And that helped me to continue to pursue the glial information.
How much glial information was there available at that point?
As far as what I could find, there wasn't a huge amount. It was glial research really only started really maybe 35 years ago in earnest, simply because the technology wasn't around to investigate their processes. So, and also at that time, the importance of glial was really questioned by neuroscientists because everything had been focused on neurons. So, you know, there was a lot of questions about glial research at the time. Now, there certainly are always questions because science is always growing and change the information is growing. But there's much more acceptance about the importance of glial.
I mean, even when I started working in, so I started training in CST in about 98. And even at that point, I think there was a lot of talk about what they could measure, you know, substantially with equipment to even understand what was going on with CSF or, you know, cerebrospinal fluid movement. And I think one of the ways I got brought into your work was through some of the, you know, three D visual modelings that you were doing and kind of trying to look at, you know, how the system moved, how the ventricles moved. And I think that was probably around 2012. I think maybe I was impressed, by the way, that, you know, somebody who was older than me was figuring out this stuff and getting it up online, because I'm only 50 and I didn't have a, you know, computer till I was in my late 20s. So there are still things that I'm quite challenged by. But the fact that you had done such, you know, amazing models, I brought them in, and I think I mentioned to you that I used them talking at a conference at one point. I was because of the work that I do with newborns, I got in to talk about, you know, some kind of oral dysfunction issues with babies. But I wanted to help them understand. I was getting brought in through lactation consultants and OTs and PTs and stuff. And I got to the conference, and of course I was like the only man in the room of 100 women or something. But I needed something that I could really show, that help people understand the system. And your stuff was the best stuff out there by far.
Oh, well, thank you. I appreciate that. But the animation, the illustrations and the animations that I do really came from the teaching. Because when I started to teach, you know, I mean, as far as craniosacral therapy, it's about a system and the components of that system.
Yeah.
We could say that those three bags we were talking about, as well as the fluid contained in those bags, whether they can move efficiently or not. And that movement is micro movement, small movement. So when we're talking about things moving or not moving, if you're going to teach that material, it's nice to see something move or not move to inform,
absolutely,
right, what you're being asked to feel.
Yeah.
So then at that time, when I first started teaching, I would make all these three-dimensional things out of either balsa wood or rubber bands or, you know, cloth and paint.
Yeah,
and stuff. You know, I'd be traveling around all over the place, lugging three suitcases full of stuff, which, gotta tell you, gets old after
all. Yeah.
And so then I don't know why I thought of animation, but I think it was a little quote I read from a physiologist that said something like, what is it? A drawing is worth 100 words or something, or 1,000 words, something like that.
And
said, but an animation is worth 10,000 words.
Yeah.
Right? So I thought, well, let me start to play around with animation, see if I could get that to work. You know,
did you have any background in it from your art career?
Oh, no. Are you kidding me? I was a sculptor. Yeah. I was like, give me something in my hands to hold on to do. You know, not this like computer drawing thing and then, you know, think three-dimensionally on a flat screen. And, you know, and then I started to play around with 3D modeling, which was really hard to me because I just started like with a face. Right?
Yeah.
And since I was used to having something in my hand,
the
person's nose would be sticking out the back of their head.
but there's something about you, I think, maybe having that perspective of being able to sort of like, you know, once you have your hands on something like that and can think about how it feels three-dimensionally, you can, you know, if you can animate it, you can start to understand what that would feel like. I think that helps too.
Yeah. I mean, it helps to have my background as far as being a sculptor to translate that into biology or physiology to help the learning experience. students. But at the same time, what it helps me is to clarify the information in myself.
Yeah.
You know, because as I go to me, to illustrate something or to animate something or to clearly describe something, I need to understand it at a certain level, you know? And so then it brought up a lot of questions for me in the sense of, well, I don't even know what the heck this really is. I mean, so, and that's wonderful to then dig deeper into it, the material in that way.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I think that's part of was, you know, it's interesting doing, and one of the things I'm really impressed with just about everybody I've trained with through UpLedger is the ability to, you know, really develop the language around what we're working with and have visual models. I mean, I think that's one of those things. I got kind of pushed into craniosacral work right out of massage school. And I didn't even plan to do body work as a field, a career. I was an English major, mm-hmm. and musician for a few years while I was trying to figure out if I wanted to go into teaching or what I wanted to do. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there was just something that happened while I was in massage school trying to figure out kind of a back problem that I was struggling with for years.
Right.
Where I think I just developed a real sensitivity, you know, with all the stuff that was going on with my own body. So when I could feel something with my hands, you know, I had a lot of questions or I noticed things that other students didn't notice. And so one of my teachers right away said, you know, UpLedger is doing a series of workshops and I'm going to be there. Why don't you go take the first level right out of school? Oh. And I was like, okay. And you know, the first day of class is, you know, something new like this, you get a lot of people too who are like really searching for something and sometimes not as grounded. And so there's also again, I'm probably one of the only men in the course again, as it usually is. But I you know, it felt a little woo-woo when I first got in there, but within the first, you know, before lunch, I was already like, there's something really amazing going on here just because of the way that it was being presented. And by the end of that course, I was already sold. I was basically ready to start working. And luckily I had already kind of had a decent practice started right out of school. And so mm-hmm. I was, you know, talking people into letting me take a little extra time and practice, and didn't take mm-hmm. long before I kind of went down that road. But those models, you know, that was the thing that really drew me in. And part of the reason I was probably over asking in your course was because there's something about understanding what an entire process looks like and how things connect that I'm, you know, always drawn to.
Yeah. And I think we had to, perhaps I do rather, thank Dr. UpLedger for that, you know, because he really thought of himself as a simplifier of complex information. And he was very much a person of language. He wasn't necessarily a visual person, although he did some, in my opinion, really beautiful little drawings that I don't think hardly anyone has ever seen. But he had a visual sense for sure. But of course, he was a musician. So like
that's
you.
That's right.
So,
that's right.
Right. So he had that sensitivity and he had that ability to listen deeply, right, on a lot of levels. Yeah. And so, but simplification was often his focus. And the reason he explained to me that he simplified information is so that he could bring that information into his clinical practice.
Yeah.
So it would be simple in his understanding, therefore simple in his hands and his application of the material.
Yeah.
So I have to thank him, I mean, for a million things.
Yeah. To me, I started out really a little more focused on trigger point therapy and more neuromuscular therapies. And I got into studying functional movement, you know, partly to, again, solve some of my own problems. But also I started realizing there's, you know, the educator in me wanted to start giving my clients something to, you know, do with, you know, with once we kind of freed up something that was, you know, chronically tight, or we had some, you know, change in mobility, I wanted to start giving them things to sort of integrate. And yeah, I just, there was something about the simplicity of the craniosacral work from the beginning, and it was in the results too. I mean, some of the things that I saw happen early in my career and especially doing baby work. I mean, I know you treat babies as well. Mm-hmm. You know, just seeing the shift, the first baby that I treated was, I hadn't done any baby work yet. And I had a midwife that I was treating for a long time. And she kept trying to pull me into the fold and say, you know, babies could really use this. And I've seen so many problems that I think would be helpful. Mm-hmm. But she had a baby who had really asymmetrical cranials. At about 6 weeks, the eye was still really compressed. Mm-hmm. And she said, will you just, you know, do an eval for me just to give to this doctor? They want to put the baby in a cranial cap. I'd really like to not go that direction if we don't have to. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I'm just, you know, feeling, I did some reading. I looked at a lot of different things about, you know, the way babies' cranials are shaped, but that's as much training as I had at that point with mm-hmm. pediatrics. And so just kind of had my hands on, just trying to feel what I noticed with tissue. And of course, stuff started to, you know, move a little bit. And within mm-hmm. a week, the parents sent me a picture, and I was totally blown away. And they were getting ready to move out of New York in like 2 weeks. So they came back for a couple more sessions, and within that time period, things just moved so fast that then I was hooked. And then I was like, okay, I might go this direction too.
Yeah, that's great. Mm-hmm.
But that's the, you know, after treating, you know, chronic back pain and shoulder problems mm-hmm. and neck problems for years, I was probably maybe 10 or 12 years into my career at that point. I was, you know, those were such long projects compared to this kind of thing that it just, mm-hmm. it's completely changed the way I even think about treating adults.
Yeah. How has it changed the way you think about treating adults from your experience with children?
Well, I can't help but think of my adults as babies.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, just there's something about really trying to think about their whole experience rather than just treating them as, you know, an adult, you know, a stressed adult in pain, you know, the way that you do when you first start working with them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
How about you?
Well, I mean, I think it's that aspect of the totality of the person that, and not to treat in regards to the symptoms presence, right?
Yeah.
That it's the whole person that's experiencing these symptoms. And so then, certainly the symptoms are important and the causes of those symptoms important as well, but not to forget the totality of the person. And that's, I think, one of the gifts of this work is that we always come back to the whole being. You know? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, you know, that at that point I hadn't taken some of the advanced courses yet. And so then I took a course with Stan Jerome. Mm-hmm. And I ended up taking another one with him later on because, you know, I felt like that work was so critical. Also, being a word person, I think, you know, and from, you know, especially when I was doing more movement work with people, I'm doing more hands-on body work at this point. But when I was teaching movement a little bit more, the words became very important and sort of repeating the phrasing and, you know, that kind of stuff. And I think I picked up in Stan's work the way that we could, you know, really engage the person having the experience with those words and having worked with babies at that point too, I just knew that there were layers. And also being a mess on the table myself in one of Stan's courses, that needs to happen as well, because I got to sort of experience myself and at different levels too.
Right. Yeah, I mean, so then I think in this work we call craniosacral therapy from Upledger, he brought in these various layers, and he left us with cell talk and to the, I think, an invitation of the next layers to investigate levels of consciousness.
Yeah, you know?
And so. It's, I think he's given us many beautiful gifts, and he's given us a number of parting gifts and pointing in a certain direction.
When did you start doing body work? Were you still in the art world at the time?
Oh, yeah, I was. You know, I had my loft, and I was, I was a sculptor mainly.
Yeah.
And then, but I was also a furniture maker, carpenter, cabinet maker. So in my studio.
Handy in general then.
Yeah, it was a woodworking shop as well.
Yep.
Yeah, and then I had I still do ankylosing spondylitis.
Yeah, that's right. I remember you telling us that.
Mm-hmm. So it's, for the audience, it's considered autoimmune disease. that affects the connective tissue encasing the vertebral column.
Yeah.
And it naturally calcifies, so it hardens.
Yeah.
In Chinese medicine, it's called bamboo spine, because if you looked at an x-ray, it looked like a piece of bamboo fused together. So initially, it was crazy pain. I mean, just maddening pain.
When were you starting to feel it? At what age?
The pain?
Yeah.
Oh, probably when I was about 22, 23.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so then I was in New York. My sister was a dancer in New York as well. And, you know, dancers, they know all the greatest therapists in the world because they're just all messed up all the time.
Yeah. Well, one of my favorite physical therapists who's in New York, who helped me, and also then I led into craniosacral work, which she does now. But she traveled with Merce Cunningham and Mark, worked out of Mark Morris Dance Studio and stuff. So I got the benefit of all of her experience too.
Yeah. And so, you know, dancers and all the injuries that they have to work through really know some fantastic therapists.
Yeah.
And so I went to a lot of really great people until then eventually I found this person, Anjani DiBello. She's a physical therapist and she was in Midtown, New York at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to see her and it completely changed my life. I mean, just was remarkable.
What kind of treatment was she doing with you at the time?
Cranial.
Yes, okay.
Just that's it. You know, I didn't even know what it was. I mean, she asked me if I wanted to know anything and I said, no, I just feel like I want to feel better. That's all. I don't really want to know what you're doing, how you're doing or anything about it.
Yeah.
And, she was wonderful. I saw her a lot and she really changed. I mean, I was in such high level pain and sleep was terrible. Energy was terrible. And just after the first few sessions, things started to change for me and it was really wonderful. Mm-hmm.
So then did you pursue, did you go into a massage program or how did you end up getting into body work?
Yeah. Okay. Massage. Uh-huh. Yeah. That was the easiest route for me at that time.
Yeah.
And my son was living with me as well. So, so that just made the most sense.
Yeah.
And I think I had received some massage and that was helpful for brief periods of time.
Yeah.
And I thought it was interesting and it's working with my hands. Right. So, Mm-hmm. So then I went, got a massage license and then started to pursue cranial training.
Okay. Mm-hmm. What school did you go to? Some in New York?
Swedish Institute.
Swedish. Okay. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Then it was this little dumpy place.
I've heard stories. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it was this real little funky dumpy place, but it was great. It was a great education.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I had this very sort of strange situation too, because I had a friend whose mom worked at the Aveda Institute. I think it used to be called Horst actually, but Horst Reckelbacher, who started the Vedal, product line, but he was kind of an out there thinker too. And, he was friends with Deepak Chopra and all these people.
Mm-hmm.
So the program had a, kind of interesting, bent to it, but I ended up getting just an incredible education, I think, partly because they had such a high teacher to student ratio and it was really a pretty small place for the most part. Mm-hmm. But, that those kinds of experiences, I mean, it changed, that was the beginning of me really just thinking about, my own body and care for myself and all these different things. I didn't think I was going to do it as a career either. I kind of just got pulled in. I couldn't help myself.
Yeah. From the Swedish Institute for me at that time, that was a great education. And it just opened up this whole other world for me. I mean, anatomy, physiology, function, relation of structure to function. It was wonderful. And then after 9/11, they were great. They had a new place by then.
Yeah.
And they let us use it for trauma treatment. So I was in Florida at that time, and we came up and treated over 100 New Yorkers who were there, right, during 9/11. And so they were really gracious and generous to allow us to use the space. Yeah, I think for 6-7 days.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I was there at the time too. So I had just been in New York for a year, and I ended up, you know, that ended up being the start of me becoming very busy as a therapist in New York. Just so many different things. I also lived in that part of Brooklyn where a lot of the firefighters, you know, came from.
Oh yeah, Cobble Hill area.
Cobble Hill, Red Hook. You know, that was that Red Hook Fire Department got hit hard, and so that my business was like right kind of on the edge of Red Hook and Cobble Hill. So.
Saw
a lot of them, treated them for a long time, treated some police, and, you know, I treated people who walked across the bridge, you know, after all, you know, buildings fell and everything. So it was the beginning of me sort of understanding that, you know, the use of craniosacral, you know, in those kinds of situations could be so profound, and it was the right, you know, it was the right amount of force for somebody who had been through something like that.
Oh yeah. Mm-hmm. You know. Yeah, yeah, for sure. Yeah, big shout out to the firefighters and police of New York.
Yeah.
Where we were too, where at that time we were in Brooklyn Heights. So, you know, anyone who hasn't lived in New York, that just so you know, that the fire station in your neighborhood is the hub of your neighborhood.
Yeah.
You know, if you have a little kid, everybody grows up knowing all the guys and gals and dogs and everything. So
they're so
integral to the community, and any loss of any firefighter or police officer is devastating to the neighborhood and the city as a whole. Many thanks to them and their families.
And that area just happens to be also where a lot of people moved there because they worked downtown.
Oh yeah,
you know, just across the Brooklyn Bridge. So you know, it impacted that area so greatly, and you know, to be part of it. Sometimes when people ask me about the experience, that there's a bit of a I don't know if I would call it PTSD, but there are certain aspects of it that I don't remember as clearly. You know, I think there because I also worked, you know, six blocks from the towers. I had to kind of, you know, I had to keep going back down there. You know, the Friday after all that happened, I was in the city to have a meeting, you know, to try to figure out what to do. So, you know, there was a lot of that time period for me that, you know, I feel like I'm still kind of picking up pieces. Oh yeah, I remember, I forgot about this part. And I have a couple good friends who were there living with me there at the time too. So every once in a while, we end up having these conversations about what we went through together.
Yeah, we had just left the city. We had just left Brooklyn right before 9/11.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, it was maybe a month and a half, maybe 6 weeks before we moved down to Florida so I could start working at the Institute.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, anyway.
Yeah. Well, so can we go back into what I want to kind of bring some of your work in this, you know, as it relates to this glial system. As it relates to, I think, you know, what some of the bigger disease elements are that we're still struggling to find treatment for, and how critical it might be to understand this aspect of our nervous system and its ability. Because I've seen some of the blog posts that you've done and some of the writing that you've done around dementia and Alzheimer's in particular. But I think it probably relates to Parkinson's and Lou Gehrig's and ALS and lots of different things. What is it that you see, you know, going on there that is related to these kinds of autoimmune type challenges?
Originally, glial cells were, their name means glue. So glial cells were thought to be a cell type that just held together neurons and neural networks. And the reason they were thought of that originally by researchers over 100 years ago is that they didn't have the technology to see what glia were doing. So that's how they were thought. And then the focus, of course, naturally, was upon neurons and the work of neurons. But if we think about the brain and spinal cord as a garden, right, and neurons as the flowers, the star, the flowers are the focus of the garden, the flowers and the vegetables in the garden. If we simply have all of our attention upon the flowers and the vegetables, but we ignore the soil, the moisture, the drainage, right, the nutrients, the defense mechanisms for little bugs and things, right?
Yeah.
Then we're only looking at a very small segment of the totality of the, in this case, the organ, right? And so what appears is that as the brain and spinal cord evolved, it became more and more complex. Yeah. And neurons are used by the brain and spinal cord to receive, store, organize, and transmit information. So as that complexity grew and grew and grew, it is thought, right? Mm-hmm. That neurons lost their ability to maintain their environment.
Yeah.
So that means that then the glial cells took up that role.
Ah, I see. Okay.
Right. So then back to the garden analogy, let's say that in the garden, if you never clear out the weeds, right, then the weeds will take over and kill the flowers and the vegetables. Right. So we can think of the weeds as maybe in relationship to the organ, the brain, and spinal cord as waste material. So
in this case, like amyloid beta or something, right? Something that's clogging up the...
Amyloid beta is always being produced by the brain and spinal cord. But there has to be a production and clearance system, right? So trouble arises when clearance of those, of amyloid beta, right, allows it to accumulate in the spaces of the brain, and that clogs the movement of fluid and nutrients, and that stresses the cells, and the cells eventually will die off, right? So then if we don't take a look at this cleansing mechanism, then we're ignoring a big part of the environment, right? So in the case of Alzheimer's, there has been research that shows that when there's a decrease in the clearance of interstitial fluid, meaning the fluid where you find the cells that's carrying amyloid beta and other products that need to be cleared out, then they accumulate, and then that's a sign of Alzheimer's. But it goes beyond that to many other forms of pathology, right? Yeah. Not only, you know, you had mentioned Parkinson's or Huntington's or ALS, but mood disorders, difficulty thinking, depression, schizophrenia, I mean, on and on and on we can go. Autism spectrum disorders, sensory processing disorders. And that is simply in regards to the decrease in the ability of the system to cleanse. But these glial cells are doing much more than just creating a mechanism or a system of cleansing. They're doing many other things as well. And so there's sometimes you'll read this saying by glial researchers that the basis of neuropathology is gliopathology. So that, back to the garden analogy, unless we take care of the totality of the environment, that the neurons are going to have a very hard time functioning.
I love that analogy that of the garden. I just did a podcast with a regenerative farmer. And so we basically talked about soil science. I mean, it seems so very similar, and you know, in some respects, to bring it back to the simple. I mean, when our systems are stressed because of, you know, poor nutrients, or when our systems are stressed by our environments, that diminishes the production of cerebrospinal fluid, and I mean it causes, you know, problems with the structure, with the tissues too, right? Doesn't the dural membrane kind of become a little more contracted under when we're in a fight or flight response?
Oh, so if we're talking about the relationship of stress to neuropathology or gliopathology, so that stress itself causes a increase of glucocorticoids in the central nervous system. And then over time, that leads to cell stress and cell irritation, right? But it can also lead to inflammation.
Okay,
right?
So,
and then inflammation is a healing state, but if it becomes a chronic state, that can become harmful.
Yeah.
So then chronic inflammation can also then affect what you had suggested with those three bags, the meningeal system, or the system that produces cerebrospinal fluid. And then, so it can cause a decrease in cerebrospinal fluid production, or it can then cause a breakdown in that area, which is called the blood cerebrospinal fluid barrier. Can think of it as a little gateway that where elements of blood are filtered and through to create cerebrospinal fluid, and then some of those elements are used to produce certain other things that go into cerebrospinal fluid. So that can become too open, right? It can lose its barrier function, and then products that should stay out of cerebrospinal fluid enter into it, and that can cause harm. And there are other barriers as well, right? So then, so then either accumulation of waste, infiltration of toxins, environmental agents, buildup of various proteins can cause a chronic state of inflammation, and that can lead to brain and spinal cord stress, which then can be expressed as neuropathology.
And that's the thing that I find, getting back to the simple again, is like that something so simple as, you know, this low force work, and for anyone who hasn't experienced craniosacral work, we're talking 5 grams of, you know, of pressure on on this system to, you know, both to engage it, sometimes to help it find its way back to balance, free up restriction, things like this. It's so subtle and it's so little, but a stressed system, a lot of times, as Upledger's teachers often say, stress systems don't heal. And stress systems also, I think, can't handle a lot of heavy force or heavy drugs or that kind of thing either. So to be able to even start sometimes with somebody with something so simple and to get it and to get positive response, it's so encouraging for so many people when they're able to, you know, get something just from that little amount.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of power in gentleness. A delicate acceptance, right? So I usually say match our palpation to the scale of the structures we're working with or we're observing or we're focusing on. And if you think of the brain and spinal cord, it's the most delicate organ in the whole body. So then how can we match this delicacy with our awareness and our palpation? And I think that being in the presence of someone who is with you in that delicate state, right, helps us internally relax. Through that state of relaxation, our stress can decrease, our autonomic nervous system can come back into greater balance, and that leads to a higher state of healing. So delicacy, tenderness, compassion, and acceptance is, to me, the central part of cranial work.
And it's interesting too, because the depth of research and the depth of what you guys have shown anatomically, we sort of hold in our consciousness while we're working, but really just our presence is the most important part. It's almost like, you know, we our ego really loves to have all this information and you know, think that we can, you know, have control over different kinds of things. But I think in the end, that just serves as a map and as sort of a background for the work that we're doing, which is really just being present for someone's process.
I worked a lot with Dr. Upledger in the clinic, co-treating, and to me, time and time again, one of the most beautiful things about the way he worked and taught through his example was that he knew an enormous amount. I mean, just an enormous amount. But he never let that information guide what he was feeling, right? He always kept it around, available. He didn't ignore it or throw it away. He was constantly learning. But he lived by the saying that the client always knows more than I do. So it is our job, I believe, through deep listening, to be led by the client, because the client who knows a client better than the client? And right. So even though, you know, it can be difficult to find our pathways to healing and better health, it is still there. And to have someone with you who's willing to listen deeply to that in another person,
yeah.
I think is truly empowering for the person receiving the work. And I think also the belief of the practitioner is hugely important too, because that transfers to the client.
Yeah.
And has a really positive effect.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think knowing how the structure can heal. I mean, really, really knowing it down to the details that you get into. When we're talking down to the cellular level, I think some people think, well, if you're a hands-on practitioner, why do you need to know things down to that level? And I think it's part of what you're saying. It's like there's part of me, and this is partly from going through a sort of a chronic pain period too, is the belief that we can heal, and yeah. and understanding what the mechanism for healing is in the first place. Helps us, you know, create that confidence for the person who is really in a state most of the time where they're not sure they're ever getting better. They think it's just because of age or whatever the situation is, that we help to sort of, sort of lift up that what's going on with them at that level.
Oh, I think that's very true, you know, and I think placebo research has shown that the beliefs, the thoughts of the practitioner has an effect upon the outcome mm-hmm. of the treatment. So I think it's helpful to know things, but that which at the same time, because I think that helps us to deepen our experience,
yeah.
because we have a deeper knowledge base.
Yeah.
While at the same time, that which is known is always changing. And that which is known, well, for instance, if you read research about various things, cells or something, that research can also be contradictory. Yeah. So then, even though you may know the subject in a broad way, there are always questions,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
It comes back again to the individual person we're working with still yeah. knows more than we do, no matter how much we may know,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
And so how can we be present so that we're guided by that person rather than guided by what we know.
Yeah.
And I think working in this terrain of the unknown in cranial work is indeed one of the most beautiful things about the work.
Yeah.
Because we can, it's important to know things, but it's important to let those things go.
Yeah.
So we can be with the client as clearly as possible.
Yeah.
And that to me is, in my experience as a client, is beautiful and really helpful and enlightening, and in my clinical experience with others as well.
Yeah,
yeah,
mm-hmm. yeah. That's what I've really picked up from a lot of the training and from Stan's work as well. With, you know, really being able to figure out how to ask questions in a certain way. Like I find, and even working with children, you know, there's something, for whatever reason, I have a knack of working with kids. Maybe because I'm a little childlike in some ways too, but to what you're saying, I always think they know something that I don't know, and I'm just kind of waiting to get more and more information fed to me. And I always, you know, I talk about this a lot on the podcast, that my intake is just ongoing. I never stop with. I have actually a very short intake form. I see some people with these like 5-page intake forms, and I'm like, I don't need to know every detail of their diet and every supplement, and I want to get sort of a general idea of what their background is, what sort of experiences they've had that have been positive or negative, you know, some major things like car accidents or surgeries or that kind of thing. But the rest of it's going to unfold with me over time.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's true. I mean, for you and a lot of practitioners, other practitioners, I think we're all unique, right, as a practitioner. And so we have our different ways in which we go about organizing ourselves to help someone. And
yeah,
maybe
that's true.
You know, tons. And but it's also about how do you let that go? I mean, how, and it could be from the first time you meet the person, but let's say you treat the person 8 times, yeah? Well, the ninth time you may see the person, how do you let those eight times go, right, and not determine right what you find and work with in the
yeah
ninth.
Yeah.
And that is a constant quest for me as a practitioner to be able to do that efficiently, because I'm the sort of person that likes to know stuff.
Yeah.
You know?
I
just do. Big part of this work is to know it, but be guided by the client. And one of my great experiences, that one was when we worked with the conjoined twins at the Institute.
Oh yes, I know the story. Yeah,
to prep them for separation, and I was in charge of the intensive program at that time. And before the boys came, I mean, we had remarkable scans of their brain and bony structure. We even had 3D. With 3D models of their cranium and face.
Unbelievable.
You know? Yeah, it was unbelievable, the amount of information we had. But even though we had all that information, it was the moment-to-moment experience that was where the truth was found. So that to me is a really beautiful part of this cranial work.
Yeah, agreed. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I appreciate you taking the time to do this. I know you're a busy guy, and I wanted to have you on. I've thought about you since I started this about 4 years ago. You've been in the back of my mind as somebody that I thought people need to know more about. Your work, your book is amazing. It's called Brain Stars, if anyone's interested in checking it out. It's really more of, I mean, it's a textbook of sorts. But there are some pieces in there that I think, you know, just going through it, anybody who's in a health related field, I think there's a lot to gather from that book. And just, you know, I appreciate so much the presence that you've brought to the coursework that I've studied through you and pretty much everybody at Upledger. So I kind of wanted to give a little shout out. You're the first person from Upledger that I've learned from that's been on the podcast. So,
thank you. I appreciate that. Yeah. Thank you very much. And thank you for having me. I appreciate it. And I appreciate all your work as well. So you and your family, be well, safe, healthy.
Thanks, Dad. You too. Stay well.
Thank you. You stay well, and look forward to seeing you again whenever all of us in the world can see each other.
Likewise. Yeah. All right. Have a good one.
Okay. Take care.
Tad Wanvier, folks. How great was that? I hope this helped simplify some complex information for you. This is what good teachers do, and if they're really good, they also stoke curiosity and the mysteries. And nearly every subject I've studied through Upledger brings me into a new awareness, a tradition that I'm hoping to carry on with each episode here through these conversations. Health is an ever-evolving state, and in my experience, it's through living with greater awareness that we are able to improve our state of being. And as we discussed here at the end, the science, it always serves as an important framework, but it's our presence to one another's experience that is the most important thing, no matter what activity we're engaged in. Let me know what you thought of this topic and conversation. Reach out to me anytime through our contact page over at highway2.health, and you'll find a link in the show notes here on the app you're listening to. Also, I'll have some links here for Tad's work and for his book, Brain Stars, Glia Illuminating Craniosacral Therapy. Thanks for listening and for all that you do. Be good to yourself, be kind to each other, and take care of your planet. Be well, my friends.
If you enjoyed podcasts like this, you should check out our other shows on Health Podcast Network. For example, Better with Dr. Erica, hosted by Dr. Erica, provides support and guidance in navigating stress-related challenges to transform your relationship to self-care. Each episode arms you with the tools needed to be better, do better, and live better. There was an incredible episode that you should check out called Touch and Connections as Tools for Healing and Better Mental Health. In this episode, her guest breaks down ways to use physical touch as a form of healing for trauma and grief. Check out Better with Dr. Erica on your favorite podcast platform or visit healthpodcastnetwork.com.